This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. My guest today is Brian Kaplan, professor of economics at George Mason University, prolific author and blogger at Bet On It. At this point, I don't know how many times Brian's been on the show. It's been a lot. And I'm always glad to learn he's got a new book out because it means that we're going to have another chance to talk, which we will be today, about his latest book, You Will Not Stampede Me, Essays on Nonconformism. Brian Kaplan, welcome back.
Fantastic to be here, buddy.
So I'll start with a little note on structure, I guess, because you break up the essays in this book into four sections: disobedience to authority, the world is wrong, the weird is right, and nonconformist candor. And so I thought we'd start, I don't know, at the beginning, which opens with the essay that gives the book its title, You Will Not Stampede Me. And in that essay, you argue that whenever there's a public crisis, or I guess I'll say an ostensible crisis, it's almost inevitably accompanied by hysteria and herding. So maybe you could talk a little bit about all the hysteria and herding that you see in all these public crises. Inevitably?
Almost inevitably, anyway. So the hysteria, you live through pretty much the same crises that I have. Each time that a crisis gets declared, people are supposed to run around like chickens with their heads cut off. Like, oh my God, Kuwait's been invaded. We got to do something about this. Oh no, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. This is terrible. Right? Or, we've got a disease with a very, that is much more dangerous than normal ones, but still, when we do the math, you're losing a few statistical days. Let's go and rearrange our whole society for a couple of years on that basis. And then the herding. And this means that people are expected to get in line. If you sit around saying, well, but I don't really know about this, just think about the Kuwait war, just think about someone saying, I think we shouldn't go and support them unless they agree to recognize Israel first. Like, just shut up. No, we're doing this. We're going to go and have a war. We're going to do this. We don't want anyone distracting us. Everyone get in line. Do what you're told. Don't cause trouble.
Okay. I guess I'll say I'll agree partially with you at least. But, I mean, hysteria is never going to be a good response. But I think on the other end, people say, well, if you don't get people emotionally worked up, especially when there's a potential grave danger, well, that could be erring in the other direction. And do you concern yourself with that at all?
Ever so slightly. I just say there's such a tendency towards getting more worked up than would make sense. And especially remember, the hysteria is also crowding out other issues. It's not just like, well, we'll never do anything unless we get hysterical. It's like, well, if we get hysterical about the things that we're supposed to, then we are probably going to wind up neglecting other things. I mean, to me, the most obvious and overwhelming problem facing humanity is just death. There's almost no research on serious life extension. Like, we'll figure out ways to keep you alive longer in a hospital when you're 88 with severe dementia, but actually working on the really big problem that concerns all human beings, people barely care about that. Instead, you're weird if you're worried about life extension. Say, like, that's obviously a way bigger problem than the kinds of stuff that people do get worked up over. In principle, is it possible to be complacent and underworried? Sure it is. I just say I've gone through 50 years of life, and it seems like when you list all of the things that people have gotten really worked up over, none of them seem like they were such big deals in the broad scheme of things to me.
But if I think about this from a public policy perspective, I think, well, I know enough about this stuff to know that policy windows tend to be open only for brief periods of time. And if you don't get that sort of emotional response, it might be difficult to get anything done, if you, even if you have to overplay the seriousness of something. And so there's a policy consideration as well, too. And maybe that points to the brokenness of our system. But if you have to work in that brokenness,
never let a crisis go to waste.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But I take it that you would say that that's not really a good basis of operating under.
Right. I mean, especially if it seems like the things that we choose to get hysterical and hurt on are pretty arbitrary anyway, and they're not actually anywhere close to the biggest problems.
Yeah.
The worry that we'll wind up going and making enormous sacrifices for a problem that isn't all that serious, we'll wind up making things worse. These very rarely get brought up, but I think that these are totally reasonable concerns just given historical experience.
I wonder if there's a distinction we wouldn't want to make between becoming hysterical and responding with hysteria. Because when I think about the actual responses, sometimes they're very different. Like 9/11 was this incredibly, probably the most immediate traumatic event in my lifetime. But it took us like...
I mean, I think COVID was way worse.
Well,
than that.
No, I mean, in its immediate.
They closed Disneyland.
but even so, I mean, it's not like the responses are right. So I'm wondering if a lot of this is just sort of the public facing hype, but really the people in charge who are actually responding in a meaningful way aren't being hysterical, and so we sort of get the best of both worlds or one world, or I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I'd say that's the hope, and this might be the Machiavellian story you tell after the fact, which doesn't make it wrong. The main thing I would say is usually after things subside, a lot of new information comes out, and then we see what was going on. Like, so for example, we see the U.S. wasn't keeping a secret plan for the reconstruction of Iraq or Libya or Afghanistan. They just didn't have a plan. They had a detailed plan for how they're going to fight a war, and then what are we going to do afterwards? Like, oh, I don't know, we'll have some democracy or something. So it is at that level of total negligence where you're willing to go and kill a lot of people, and then like, well, what happens afterwards? We'll cross it when we come to it.
So I've been focusing a lot on the hysteria part of things, but you also mentioned that hurting, and I want to talk about that as well, because I could argue potentially a certain amount of hurting at least is a good thing, at least for, you know, a lot of people. If people feel that things are just not going well, they don't understand what's going on, well, there's a certain amount of comfort in sticking with the herd. I don't imagine you would necessarily disagree with that, or maybe you would.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way, just like the very fact that people do psychologically tend to conformism, it's because it is more comfortable. The problem is that, look, if someone has actually figured out a fantastic plan and the regular people don't understand it, the best thing is indeed everyone just follows orders to the letter and it all works out. Say, like, that's not the world we're generally in. It's very rare. And instead, normally the plan is not very good. Even if it's very well worked out at the level, the details of the day, it's often still very poorly worked out from a larger perspective. So, like, what if we think about this? Germany, on the one hand, during most of World War II, it seemed like they had really good plans day to day or month to month. It's like, all right, like, first we get this country, then we get the next country. Like, yeah, what's the long run plan? Let's see. We take over the world somehow? Like there's really no even halfway decent long run plan. But you are able to go and get society moving in a direction, even if in the end, if you keep walking that direction, you'll fall over a cliff. So, yeah. Logically speaking, of course, you're right, Michael. It could be. I just look at history and say, yeah, I don't see the hurting is really working out very well because the people with the plans are not actually careful, thoughtful people who are just or have a reasonable response to the situation. I said it's more of a demagogic response where it's like, well, I got to do something. Well, let's get moving here and we'll figure out the other stuff later on. Or maybe the other stuff will get figured out in 20 years by someone other than me and people have just forgotten what I did, which is basically Afghanistan, for example. U.S. stays there for almost 20 years. And what was ever the plan?
Or I guess you mentioned earlier, death, right? You say, well, you know, maybe they'll figure it out by the time I'm actually ready to go.
Well, I mean, that's one where there's just so little going on. People just think, yeah, it's just so pointless. And there's also a lot of people who though they want to spend a pile of money to keep people on respirators alive, but say, oh, well, death is actually a good thing. This kind of, it's just actually good that people get old and die because otherwise the movies would get tired. Right. Ridiculous excuses people have in favor of death.
Yeah. Now, but there's another problem that you bring up with hurting in one of the essays, and you say oftentimes it'll lead to people identifying with groups or causes. There's at one point you wrote a sort of admonition, I guess, never identify with large unselective groups. Instead, restrict your identity to groups that are small, selective, or both. So why is this good advice?
Statistically, any group that's large is just going to have some terrible people in it. It's not absolutely essential, but it's like name any group of a million random people. And like, I'll do a little Googling and I'll find a horrible ex-mer among them. It's just the way that human nature is that there's no large group of people that's so good that it doesn't have some awful members. And the problem is if people really identify with that group, their reaction when you point out these bad people is to take it as an attack upon the group. And instead of having the reasonable perspective of, well, I don't like that guy. That guy's terrible, to actually go and stand up for awful people. I say this is something you really can see very easily in any kind of ethnic strife. Look, in every ethnic strife, there's got to be some people committing horrible atrocities. And yet the normal reaction when there's a conflict is people just back their own side to the hilt. It's very, you know, very much a part of human nature to do this, and yet it's also a very regrettable part. So I say, look, if there's a large group but it's selective, then you can be okay, because it's like, look, you only the people that fit these criteria count, and anybody else, they're not with me. I don't like them, right? And with a small group, you say, well, it's my family. I identify with them, but like, I've got six people in my family. I think it's really unlikely we're going to get an axe murderer, so there's not too much danger of me saying I stand by my family. But when you broaden the group and you don't raise the standards, there's a big problem. I think in that essay, I also point out that a well-run group is selective enough to just excommunicate the bad apples. But it's really rare. So I've often said, like, if I were Pope, I would just start off by saying our infallible revelation, child molesters go to hell, no forgiveness. Next revelation, I'm handing them all over to the authorities. Here's the full documentation. All right. People would say, oh, you can't do that. Yes, I just said I can. I'm the Pope. I'm totally doing it. And yet they don't. It's like, well, you've got to understand these guys. They served the church for a long time. It's like, why are you making excuses for these monsters? Why not just go help the society throw the book at them and get them away from ever hurting anybody again? And it's like, well, you know, they were Catholics and maybe not perfect, but none of us are perfect. And then away you go with going and spending church money to hire lawyers to keep child molesters out of jail.
Yeah. I guess there's a distinction I'd make between affiliating and identifying. And I would argue it's okay to affiliate with large, somewhat unselective groups like the Catholic Church or the Republican or Democratic Party. It's when you get into that area of identification that there's something you feel like there's some sort of personal stake in any attack on any member. That's when it becomes problematic.
Well, I say, like, it's really hard for a psychologically normal human to only affiliate but not identify. As soon as you affiliate, you just naturally start identifying. I mean, it's one thing to say, look, I'll go and I'll participate, but I'm not really in the group. The analogy that I like is, look, it's fine if it's ironic. So it's like, oh, yeah, I'm a Red Sox fan. It's like, all right, well, yeah, yay, Red Sox. It's a fun game, but the Red Sox are involved in a terrorist plot. It's like, oh my God, yeah, well, forget that. I'm not a Red Sox fan anymore. Never really was. It was all just sort of, as they call in professional wrestling, kayfabe, yeah, where you act like it's a big deal, but it's not. But it's just very hard for someone to belong to a party or a religion or even a professional society and not just start turning it into a skin that you wear, and one where if you're like, I'm just going to stand by everybody else who's in this group.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about my affiliations, I call them, and maybe I am just a weirdo in that sense where I feel like I can affiliate without identifying. But that's probably because I think in some senses, like you, I have a strong nonconformist streak. And so I might wear the same uniform, but I'm not really one of you guys in that culty sort of drinking the Kool-Aid way.
Right. So. Yeah, but like that, that's hard.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that I'm pushing people to do. Like in terms of like the imagined audience of this book, it's subtitled Essays on Nonconformism. I mean, to some extent, I'm trying to get people who are very conformist to at least be a bit less conformist. I mean, I don't imagine that many people who think of themselves as very conformist read the book. Probably more of what I'm trying to do actually is to get nonconformists to just be better versions of themselves. Because there are just so many nonconformists who just won't conform on anything. They just find out what's normal. Okay, I'm going to do the opposite. And I recommend against that as well. It's like, oh, maybe it's actually at least give the normal thing a chance. Don't just assume that it's terrible and do the opposite. At least be open-minded enough to assess things on their merits.
Yeah, because there's an argument, a sort of a traditional conservative argument for being normal, right? There's this sort of Burkean conservative view that says that, you know, these customs, these norms, these traditions that we have, they arose over generations after generations for good reason. And they're the glue that holds society together. And you get your crazy nonconformist Brian Kaplan folks, too many of them, and they're just pulling stuff apart. And who the hell knows what's going to happen? You know, I mean, what do you think about that argument?
Well, like, I'm not the crazy nonconformist. I'm the reasonable nonconformist, Michael. I'm someone who says, let's judge things on their merits. I mean, you know, the Burkean position is pretty crazy because it's like, well, wait a second. There's this long list of traditional stuff that you don't want to do and don't have any interest in and aren't pushing. This stuff fairly recently was actually widely accepted. So what's going on? Unless you're going to go full reactionary and say, yes, we're just going to go back to this long list of other customs. It's just quite hypocritical. Most Burkeans are really hypocritical. They don't actually plan on going and restoring anything. And there's just a lot of things that used to be standard that they've given up on or never really even thought about. I think it's more of an excuse that you pull out when something's under attack and you don't have any decent story about it. And then you say, okay, well, Chesterton's fence. I mean, this is one where I think, you know, the most reasonable reaction would be to say, like, I don't have any good argument now, but give me a while. Give me a couple of weeks. I mean, like the point of it's easy to go and dumbfound a person and you just bring up an idea they never heard of. And they're like, okay, well, unless you come up with an objection in 10 seconds, we have to do my idea. I think that's a very reasonable thing to say. No. You know, you have to give me more time than that. But on the other hand, when there is an idea that's been floating around for decades and people barely have any argument against it and it seems like there's a lot of good arguments in his favor, then I say, yeah, like get the lead out. Let's move forward. I mean, during COVID, there was an idea that a lot of experimentalists have been defending for decades of the human challenge trial, where you just get volunteers to agree to voluntarily be infected with a disease in order to see more quickly whether a vaccine works. It's a way that you can shave months off of the time. It's one where it's all voluntary. No one's being forced into it. And yet no country on earth actually did it during the emergency. And like, I think ultimately, probably a lot of it was this Burkean conservatism of, well, probably the biggest reason was actually some kind of crazy idea that as soon as you allow someone to voluntarily participate in a medical experiment, you're going to turn into Joseph Mengele. It's like, no, look, we already have human experiments, and we haven't turned into Joseph Mengele. This is just a slight variation where we are strictly respecting this bright line of did the person consent to be part of the experiment? So this is one where we really should just go and move full speed ahead. It's a great idea and would have saved a lot of lives and with clean hands.
Yeah. When you mentioned, and you've talked about that in the past before, it also makes me think about setting up markets for organ donations or transplant. That's a similar type of argument, right? That certainly could do a lot of good, but we have this almost visceral sort of, or a lot of people have this almost visceral sort of like, well, that just doesn't feel right to us. And you're saying, well, that doesn't seem like enough, right? There should be more than a feeling there. So, yeah. And
yes, especially when, look, it's a voluntary contract. It makes poor people rich, sick people healthy. And what have you got? Someone exactly like Leon Cass, who has been complaining about almost every kind of progress that's occurred in his lifetime. And when he loses, he just gives up.
Yeah.
So, you know, someone who doesn't even have the courage of his convictions to say, look, I was right about IVF in 1970 and I'm still right now. We should ban it. Doesn't matter whether millions of people get to exist as a result. It's just so dehumanizing. We shouldn't allow it. So, you know, like when someone is a layer like that, where like even they just drop the idea as soon as they see they've lost, I mean, you know, you may say this is my nonconformist streak where, like, I never drop an idea just because I've lost. It's like, yeah, look, I mean, like, it's not that I have lost. I was losing from the beginning. I don't see any prospect of anything other than losing. But look, this argument's true, so I'm going to defend it.
And I want to move on to the second part of the book, which, again, great. Yeah, you're great at titles. The World Is Wrong. And there's this essay, you open it with Crusades and You. And you start off, every 5 years or so, the United States has a major societal-wide crusade. And I read that and I thought, oh, come on. But then you listed them and I was like, oh, okay. Wow, that's okay. But then I thought, well, what's so bad about crusades? I mean, crusades mobilize the public, get us to do stuff, move us forward. Are you against moving us forward, Brian Kaplan? What's your problem?
Yeah, well, against moving us forward when the benefits are a lot smaller than the cost, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
And then there's a question, well, like, who says it's even forward?
Right, sure.
Like, maybe we're going side to side. Maybe we're going backwards. Like how do these, like, what is the process for selecting the crusade? It seems like it's mostly a dramatic event. Dramatic event, which when you step back really proves nothing. Furthermore, often, you know, like, so, you know, as I've gotten older, often I actually know the statistics that are involved. And then I say, look, this is exactly the kind of thing where we should ignore dramatic events because it is not actually a statistically important problem. Pretty sure I mentioned the BLM/George Floyd crusade there. Like, what actual numbers, total number of unarmed black men shot by police per year is barely above double digits, like 10 per year in a country of 300 plus million people, right? So it's like, gee, like, it would make more sense to be worried about kids drowning in swimming pools than this stuff. But people can still, like, actually turn a country upside down over one incident just because it happens to get filmed. And, like, the question, well, like, how common is this really? Like, does it make sense to go and condemn a society of hundreds of millions of people based upon the worst thing that happened in that year that was caught on camera? And I think that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I can already hear the response from some folks, and they say, my God, one person killed in that manner is too many. And you're not disagreeing with that. It just sounds like you're saying, well, let's consider how we should use our resources and proportionate response and that sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah, and also, like, what should it cause you to conclude about society? And it's like, well, let's see. Has there ever been a society where no innocent people got murdered? No large society anyway. So, like, where do we rank? Like, you know, like, does that show that we're terrible? It doesn't. It shows, like, there's one terrible guy. And what else? All right. That's what it shows. And, you know, like, it's pretty striking how we standardly go and tell people to not go and judge a whole ethnicity by what the worst person in that group does, but just judge a country by what the worst person in that group does, especially when it's just one low-level person. You know, to go and judge a country by their supreme leader, at least it's like, well, the supreme leader probably is kind of reflective of the whole country, but if it's just one underling, like, yeah, it proves next to nothing. You could have the nicest country in the world and still have a war criminal in there.
I think, at least on the policing issue, some people would probably respond and say, okay, I'll grant that you're right on the actual data on police murders or things that ended up being classified as murders, but it's really just symptomatic of a larger problem with policing, stopping people, so stopping while black, and all of that sort of inequality. And so we're just using this as sort of a way to illustrate a larger issue. And so therefore, pointing to one particular statistic sort of ignores the larger picture. That's what we're really trying to do.
Mm. I would say the larger picture is there's a trade-off between rightly arresting people and wrongly arresting people, between rightly enforcing laws and wrongly enforcing laws. And that's really what's getting illustrated here. It's like, well, we could never again have police mistreat anyone who's black, which is the police just say, is anyone black involved? Then we're not going to do anything. Which, as you probably know, has been a lot of the unwritten police response to BLM, is just to say, yeah, we're not going to get involved here because something might go wrong and we'll look bad. But that is, in a way, you say, like, that's a very discriminatory thing to say, yeah, we're not going to go and bother trying to go and stop black on black crime because then we might accidentally go and arrest an innocent black person. Something where, like, the trade-off is built in. And that, what I would say, is the big picture. There's a trade-off. The reason why there's so much police involvement with blacks is because the black crime is actually so high. And then it's like, well, what should be done about it? Like, just let them kill each other? Is that a reasonable thing? Like, or is it to say, like, so prioritized, never doing anything wrong that you allow horrible stuff to keep happening? I'd say, like, that is the honest way to describe the problem. I think it's also one where it's really hard for someone who's into BLM just to admit that's the trade-off. It's like, look, we should only have good things, not have bad things. You know, like, there's just no way of doing that. You know, I mean, more generally, I've often pushed people to just go and try to make more friends, meet more people. And it's like, how do I know that something won't go wrong? How do I know that if I make a new friend, that friend won't go and ruin my life? Yeah, like you don't know, but still, it's a good gamble and go for it.
You've talked a few times, you've brought up the pandemic. And so I want to ask you specifically about that, about the world being, or big parts of the world being wrong about it. I think there's a conventional wisdom, at least on the left, about, say, lockdowns, social distancing, that sort of thing, that they were, based on what we knew, they were the right thing to do. It was a good policy response because it prioritized human life over economic concerns and sort of amorphous liberty interests. And that was a good trade-off to make given what we knew at the time. I'm guessing that that's not a view you would share, right?
Right. So I can't remember which book I actually put this piece in. You've read this more recently than me, so I don't remember whether I have the quality versus quantity of life years lost under COVID policy in this book.
That's one of them. Yep, absolutely.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So basically what I did there is I just tried to go and do some basic math on on plausible estimates of how many lives were saved from policies versus the number of life. And again, normally the way that people do this with cost benefit analysis, you want to do life year saved. So saving the life of a 99-year-old isn't worth as much as saving the life of 1-year-old because the 99-year-old didn't have nearly as long to live. But then there's also quality of life, which we normally measure in life years as well, where you can say, all right, well, how about you can have a year, but you're in jail? Well, it's not as good as a regular year. So like how many months of regular time is a year of jail time worth? So anyway, what I did in the piece is try to come up with modest estimates or conservative estimates of the value of life years lost. And so that when you just go and do the math, and it looks like even knowing what we originally knew, what the policies were just absurdly strict because the amount of life that was saved, you know, even on an optimistic estimate, is just nowhere in the same ballpark as the reduction in quality of life when you measure it on the same rubric, really. So we use the same metric.
Yeah.
Just to understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, so first year of COVID life, how many months of regular life is a year of COVID life worth? And normally when I ask people, almost everybody says, I don't know, maybe, you know, a lot of people say like 6.
Okay.
Right. But I say, all right, how about we go up to like 10, oh, yeah, something like that.
That's going
to
be my.
That means that like for a year of that, every person in the US uses 2 months of life, 0.6 years. And we go and compare that to high estimates of how much life was saved from the lockdown. And you'll see that we're talking about ratios like 15-1, because when you take a sixth of a year of life away from everybody in terms of quality of life, then that just comes up to a crazy number of life years lost, way more than anything that you could possibly get on the other side. Now, if someone says, well, look, it's important, we should always prioritize quantity of life over quality of life. You know, nobody does that, and with good reason. If you really believe this, you could never go to a movie. You should just stay home and avoid getting your car. You don't need to go, and you might get killed by a car crash on the way. And in fact, it's one of the more likely ways to die, actually, is getting killed in a car crash. So, yeah.
I think a more communitarian-focused person would respond to that argument by saying some version, oh, come on, so what? It's good that we sacrifice a little bit for the most vulnerable, say, and that's we should embrace that. And that's looking at that as just of, oh, my life is slightly worse, so these people can be alive. That's just a crazy individualistic, selfish sort of thing. And if that's the kind of country you want, oh, my God, I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, I say that a communitarian should also think about quality of life for young people, for example. So a couple of years of kids got no prom, right? But more importantly, for a couple of years, a lot of kids just had no friends. I mean, I would say that, you know, I'm actually old enough where I am around the average risk. So for me, it was not trivial, not high, but not zero. Actually, so later I did write a piece of, so how do I want my family to treat me if I'm old and there's another pandemic? And what I say is, I want you guys to keep living your lives and I'll just take my chances. I don't want you guys to have your childhood ruined by this. I don't want you to stop enjoying life. I don't want to be isolated. Don't go and say, we're so worried about infecting you. We're just going to go and leave you on your own for a year. So I do not want to be isolated. I'd rather throw the dice, which are actually still in your favor, even at a high age, and then keep living in a reasonable way. The point of, if we could have a very, very, very tiny reduction in quality of life to have a very, very large amount of life years saved, totally reasonable argument, but you need to do the math to make that argument. The normal one that people are making during COVID, as you may remember, is just, it saves lives. Okay, guess what? Every kind of safety regulation is likely to save lives. Let's never do any recreational trips ever again. That saves lives. Let's close all the swimming pools. Let's go down the list of everything everybody does that is mildly dangerous and is not necessary to keep people alive, and then we'll stop. Right? But this is just a crazy way of living, and nobody actually follows it themselves. It's not just me saying it's crazy. It's people who say they disagree with me, their own behavior says this is crazy because they don't do it themselves.
And your argument is not that this is sort of a hindsight thing. This is based on even what we knew at the time, that this was not a good trade-off.
Yeah, or at least very early. I was very careful for the first 6 weeks. But the whole time I was looking at the numbers and saying, look, are these not reliable numbers yet? What's going on? And then after a while, I said, no, these numbers are the real numbers. The risk to a person without pre-existing conditions of my age is high compared to driving. So I think it was several times my annual driving risk, which is a serious risk, but still nothing like what would justify what people were doing. And even if I were in my 80s, I would not have wanted to be isolated. So, probably wouldn't have gone to parties and things, but to not see your family and just to basically be a prisoner in your home, I consider that not a minor sacrifice. That's terrible. It's often during COVID, I said, this is it's like unemployment. Right? It's just having, being alone, having nothing to do. At least I had a bunch of kids. I had a family, so I had that. So to be a single person during COVID, or to be elderly and have your family isolating you, that's awful.
Or to be in a household with people you don't necessarily like very much, cooped up with them. And there's a lot of people like that, right? So I guess when I think about that, it just strikes me how many moving parts and how much complexity there is here, because it's not, of course, just deaths from COVID, but it's also things like long COVID and other issues. We don't even know exactly what that is, to me, it's really easy to feel overwhelmed with all of the permutations, combinations, and it almost leads to a sort of paralysis. At least I can see where it would.
It seemed more, the paralysis was just maxing out on being hyper-cautious.
Exactly. Yeah.
This was Tyler Cowen's reply to my math as well. There's also long COVID and so on. All right, fine. But you remember how we used to go and compare risks to your risk of dying in a car crash? Well, there's also things that happen in car crashes besides deaths. There's paralysis, there's brain damage, there's a bunch of other things. And that never stopped us from going and using those kinds of comparisons in order to do risk analysis before. So that's the same thing we should be doing here. Fine, we can go and put on some multiplier for the other risks, although also remember, if we're comparing it to other risks, then we put multipliers on everything.
Exactly,
wind up doing the math that way.
Yeah, the math gets really complex really quickly, I think, at that point.
Well, so it depends upon how picky you are.
Yeah.
For most practical purposes, the Laffer curve really was originally on a napkin, right? And the math that I did, I'm not claiming that it was great, but I think it was better than anything I ever saw on the news in 3 years. The math that I did in a couple of hours is better than anything that made it on the news, because they were just not asking reasonable questions. They were asking idiots questions like, will it save lives? Which is never a reasonable question. How many? At what cost? Those are reasonable questions.
Well, we think about other things other than COVID. Obviously, that was a huge thing in your view and a lot of people's view that we got wrong. When when you think of other things in recent history, let's say, I don't know, since the beginning of the Trump administration, so basically the last two administrations, are there any other things that really just jump out to you? It's like, oh my God, here was hysteria and hurting, and boy, we got this one really wrong.
Well, let's see. I mean, in a way, I sort of want to flip it around and say that there was actually something really bad that was happening during this time that hardly anybody talked about, which is rising overdose deaths from opioids. This got like some very token attention, but again, it gives you an idea about how the system is just very poorly set up to deal with actual objective magnitudes. And instead it's like, what stories do we have? Remember, so when we were kids, we had the war on drugs when overdose deaths were really low.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so and it's like, well, it's because of the war on drugs that the overdose were low. Like, yeah, I don't think that's a real story. I think it's basically that people were looking around for something to get worked up over at the time and may have moderately reduced use of the time. And then we have something much bigger and people are just bored or they're thinking about other things. Let's see. So, I mean, like under Trump, the truth is that there was very, you know, very little going on in terms of foreign policy under Trump. So I don't have too much of a complaint there. Let's see. I mean, I say like his main thing is getting really worked up over immigration. So, you know, I have this other book, Open Borders, oh, yeah, that we probably talked about. So you know, my view is the more the merrier. And I think the best thing is if people with like illegal migrants could just come legally, as many as want to come. Right? That's my general view of it. So when someone sees people coming over, it's like, well, looks bad, but like, what do you think they're going to do when if it's almost impossible for them ever to get the legal papers? So like the effort to go and stop that, I think of as a big moral panic. Yeah, so that's probably the best example.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wonder if we could, well, it seems to me that then how you're really looking at it in a sense is sort of flipping it around, saying it's not a question of what we're doing that we're getting wrong so much as the things that we're ignoring, that we're focusing on these other, whatever, hysteria, the moments, that's the problem, is the things that we're not focusing on that we really should be.
I mean, I'd say that both are true. I'd say that I think the system is so bad at finding anything good to focus on that it's best just for it to stop trying to do stuff and just say, yeah, like we're just going to live our normal lives and not try to orchestrate crusades.
But I wonder if maybe we're looking at this wrong and we're engaging in a bit more than a bit of negativity bias, right? Because we focus, because we focus on all these things that we get wrong, that the world gets wrong, that not that you get wrong or I get wrong, of course, but
yeah, we, of course not.
No, yeah, but we don't appreciate all the things we don't think about because they're not going wrong. The million and one little cogs that keep on spinning and turning like they should. And so maybe we're being unfairly harsh to a system that gets most things right, but screws up every once in a while that gets a lot of tension.
May I say, first, in terms of crusades, I think the track record is so poor. So it's not like there's a million good crusades and I pick out the five that weren't very good. I think I listed all the crusades that are notable of our lifetimes, and none of them look to me like they actually pass muster. If you're going to just go down and say, well, all right, fine, the crusades are bad, but the regular workaday stuff is good, that's a much more reasonable argument. That's one where you really have to go through a lot of details to sensibly talk about it. I've got a bunch of other books saying that we've got other large bodies of policy that are really bad. So coming up in just a couple of weeks, I have my new book on housing regulation come out, which, Michael, I assure you, it is the most fascinating book ever written on housing regulation.
I'm looking forward to it. I got to say, definitely.
Little baby build. So this is definitely one where like very few people get excited about housing regulation. But I do argue in the book that it has devastating effects and we have lost an enormous amount of value in order to avoid, again, some problems that are really quite trivial. So that is the heart of that book. There are a lot of cogs like, well, what would you do about birds that are being displaced by construction? And I guess my honest answer is, yeah, I guess tough luck for the birds. That would be my general answer. And buildings over birds is my actual position on that. But I say, look, if we just go and put some kind of a reasonable price tag on those bird nests, compare it to the building, benefits to the building way exceed it. And the fact that you can go and have a bunch of complaints and talk about them until you're blue in the face doesn't mean that it adds up to a lot. One of my favorite pages in the book, it's another nonfiction graphic novel, as I'm very interested in figuring out ways to make dry but important research actually get read and enjoyed by a large audience. So one of the things in the books is I've got a debate between a bear and a mouse, and the bear just says one big loud argument of trillions of dollars of gains. And the mouse has a dozen tiny arguments where he talks about, you know, there could be parking problems. There could be urban pig farms. We need to preserve the character of the neighborhood. And the point of the page is you can't go and beat $1 trillion arguments with $12 billion arguments, except in a debate where the person who has a whole bunch of arguments that aren't really very important, but are numerous and emotionally affecting, probably will win.
I think another problem, I mean, you're obviously a nonconformist. I understand that. I appreciate it. I'm a nonconformist too, but there are some real costs or potential costs associated with that sort of thing. Now, my attitude's always been, well, what the hell? Let's see what happens. But I think a lot of people, especially in, you know, in organizational settings, you say, well, listen, these are the best practices. This is what the consultants are telling us to do. Everyone's doing it. And hey, if it goes wrong, I'm just doing what everyone else is doing. You can't blame me. If I try this wild out there thing and it goes wrong, well, then it's my butt on the line. And I think there's a real, that makes it really difficult for people to push against the herd, especially in those institutional settings, right?
Yeah. Although it also gives you extra appreciation for how great it is that we have such an entrepreneurial culture, because the famous entrepreneurs, almost all are nonconformists. They're almost all people said, yeah, nobody's doing this. I think it's a good idea anyway, despite that, and I'm going to go and do it. And they become famous. So, Zuckerberg, Musk, these are all people who are obviously extreme nonconformists. They did something really weird with their lives. And thanks to them, we've got some incredible gains. The point that most new ideas suck, I take that very seriously. Most new ideas do suck. You know, it's great to have a system where if you're willing to bet your life savings on an idea, you can. And if it's a good idea, you get rich. And if you don't, tough luck. That is a good system. We don't exactly have that system, but say it is the most functional part of the system that we have. If you are a middle manager somewhere, I can totally understand someone saying, yeah, well, it's my neck on the line and I'm not really going to get very much out of the profit out of it. And that's where I would say, well, seems like a dysfunctional system that you're in there anyway. Be really nice if it were possible for someone to come along and change it. And at least we weren't putting impediments to someone who's willing to gamble their money on a new idea. And this is why I am so gung-ho on deregulating hostile takeovers, which since the 80s have been almost impossible. But it is a wonderful nonconformist mechanism to put your money where your mouth is if you think the status quo is screwed up. The traditional idea is you just buy 51% of the stock of a company, show up at the meeting and say, hey, I own 51%, you're all fired, this is my company now, go away. This really did happen in the old days. And now there is so much regulation that makes it hard to do that if managers of a profitable firm are failing to be anywhere near as profitable as they could be, they really have a lot of latitude to keep doing that. So that's something that is it's a really good idea if hostile takeovers are easy to do and we don't put impediments to them, because it is a way for someone who's willing to gamble on the status quo sucks and I've got a better idea to do it. If they're wrong, then they lose their shirt. If they're right, they make money. But this way, we don't wind up being stuck in the same way they are right now. Twitter, by the way, of course, that was not a hostile takeover. That was a friendly takeover where they agreed to sell. The idea of the hostile takeover is you just buy the shares from the public and then tough luck. It doesn't matter what the managers think.
You know, actually, this isn't just a libertarianish sort of argument. I've actually talked to a number of people on the left, Jacob Hacker is one of them, who've argued that, well, yes, we need to encourage more entrepreneurial activity. And one way to do that is to have a robust social safety net so people can go out. Like you said, most new ideas suck. And so if people know that they can try this and they won't be totally out on the streets living under an overpass somewhere, we're going to generate more ideas. We're going to grow the economy and it's going to actually more than pay for itself. I don't know how you feel about that, but it just occurred to me when you were talking about it.
Yeah. Look, it's not a crazy argument. I think that it's pretty phony. I think very few people actually favor the safety net for this reason. I think the main thing is, remember, is most small businesses don't even claim to have any new idea. They're just going and they just want to go and run the business themselves. So they don't even claim to have a new idea. And most people who start new businesses totally fail. So this is one where I say, look, it's one thing when you are betting your own life savings and everyone else tells you it's a dumb idea, but you think it's not. And then if you lose your life savings, then you lost it. It's another one where you have this big safety and it's like, well, I can afford to lose it. And what's the big deal? I say, well, the big deal is you blew a bunch of resources on a bad idea. And that's if taxpayers are subsidizing it, so that makes sense for them to not be too happy about it. Yeah. So I think the idea that we would actually get a noticeable increase in entrepreneurship from just having a bigger safety net is pretty crazy. And for the money, most people actually are not good enough to actually run their own business. They're just not suited to it. All right. So I can admit that I'm pushing nonconformism. I think you need to be a nonconformist to be successful. Although on the other hand, I think most nonconformists would not be good leaders.
Yeah.
You know, like you need to have the right combination of having not just being a free thinker, but having actual insight, which is a lot less common.
You know, one of the things a lot of these nonconformists have done or not done, I guess, in some cases, famously, is finish or even attend college. And you've thought a lot about higher ed and signaling and various other things. And it's, I think there's this conception of your work for people who believe they're familiar with it. It's just sort of a, we don't need no education kind of viewpoint. And hey, if you can't show me the ROI for this degree, then it shouldn't be offered, which kind of makes you sound like some sort of a soulless Philistine. And so I'm just going to ask you, Brian Kaplan, are you some sort of soulless Philistine?
Right. I am not a soulless Philistine. I do have a whole chapter in The Case Against Education called Is Education Good for the Soul? Probably the most common academic critique in my book is that I ignore all non-economic benefits of education. My reaction to that is, look, I can understand reviewing a book that you haven't read. Everybody does that. But reviewing a book without reading the table of contents, that seems kind of negligent. So, yeah, like it's not just that I think it's fine that this stuff is fine. So ideas and culture are my life. It's the stuff that I really care about. I am fascinated by it. The idea that it's a good idea to go and have taxpayers pay for someone's hobbies, I think, is a strange idea. And especially when you see how arbitrary it is. So, you almost have no college offering a program in graphic novels. And yet there's a huge fan base of that. People just study it on their own. It's a hobby. And then why is it that some other fairly arbitrarily selected group of hobbies gets to be supported by taxpayers while graphic novels don't? I don't think there's a lot of logic to it other than just that's the way that it's always been. In terms of the value conformity, I do say that education is valued to a large extent because it does signal conformity. And I appreciate, look, businesses in general want conformists because there's no I in team. They are looking for people to be on board with the project. The main thing that I say there in the book is just that if you are nonconformist, you want to figure out a way to be the good kind, to be the kind that people do want to employ. Right. And that's where I say, look, don't go and become the difficult person and make enemies with your boss. I say, really, like a real nonconformist strategy is to be your boss's best friend and say, yeah, the other workers, they're not really on board here, but I want to be your right-hand man. It's like a lot of people get resentful of that. No. You should keep solidarity with fellow workers. Like, well, how about you go and actually try to be a really good, loyal, but also truth-telling employee to your boss? And in this way, you can get rewarded for thinking in a different way. Like you've got an idea. It's like, well, like this guy's loyal, he cares about performance. Maybe we should try his idea.
You, in one of the essays, you talk about news. And at one point you say, you're right, I ignore the news in part because I deem it unreliable. And now, of course, you know what's going on in the world, obviously, and you keep up with what's going on in the world. So kind of help me understand what you're getting at here and sort of how you manage to keep up with what's going on without being pulled in by what you feel is the unreliable news you ignore.
Right. So usually if people are talking a lot about a story, I don't watch the news, don't read newspapers. I go to Wikipedia and just get the background. So I find that to be much more informative. Wikipedia article will normally go and tell you a bunch of critical facts that no one in the media actually talks about because it's unclear why. It's like, do they imagine that everybody already knows what's happened in the past 70 years of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or what? But anyway, if you go and read Wikipedia, they'll go and get you up to speed on this stuff. It's like, okay, so this is happening in context. This is how this compares to other things that have happened in these countries, around the world. I'd say that probably for a social scientist, I am unusually uninformed about the latest stuff that's happening. I just consider most of what's happening to actually not be of historic importance, and I'm not going to spend any time thinking about it. In terms of reliability, so say, like often at least the initial coverage is making a lot of serious mistakes. Say, well, what are you supposed to do? Well, just wait a little while and then read the vetted version that you can get on Wikipedia where they actually have gathered the facts. Although, I mean, really my deeper problem with the news is not so much that they're making specific factual mistakes, is just that they are pretending like they have figured out what's important to talk about in a reasonable way, and that everybody else should be talking about the same stuff as they are. And my story is no, what they think is important to talk about usually just should not be discussed at all. Like, for example, I think that plane crashes should just not be on the news. They are so rare. The only reason you put them there is to go and make people think that air travel is dangerous, and it's not. It is as safe as it's ever going to get. So, at least safe as it is anyway right now. So it's just crazy to do anything that makes anyone worry about flying. And yet the media will do it. So look, they are male. It is wrong for them even to cover the story. Like, it just makes people dumber to hear about it. I think the same goes for a lot of other things that make headlines. Like, it's so rare. It's so misleading to even talk about it. To talk about it is to say that this general worldview or this is important is correct. And it's not correct.
I think some people hearing that answer of yours or that response of yours say, wait a second, when you say Wikipedia, they do this and they compile, say, who's this day? This anonymous, these aren't professionals. These are just some random people who happen to. So don't you have, why should we trust just some random people? Where's the transparency there, as opposed to we can look at, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post, that these are journalists who've been to some of the finest Ivy League institutions in the country, whether it's the New York Times or Fox News, what have you. These are professionals as opposed to these randos that you're trusting your information to.
Yeah, so I'd say a few things. So first of all, you trust them to do what? They're doing their job, but their job is to get people hysterical about whatever the worst thing that happened in the world yesterday or today. At first glance, I think that Wikipedia is a crazy business model. You hear about it like, what? Does anybody can edit it? But the proof is from the results. So I just say, like, find any topic where you actually know a lot about it and then read the article and see how good it is. There are a lot of areas where I know a lot. And in general, when I read those articles, they're good. Right. So I am an expert in the subject and I go read it. So, all right, this is pretty good. Not perfect. Right. It doesn't say exactly what I would say, but still, this is like a something compared to what you would get from the media with the usual hysteria and lack of perspective. This is good stuff. But yeah, I mean, I can understand if you didn't know anything else about it. So saying, well, we should defer to the people who are credentialed and are also not anonymous. But just comes down to what are the results?
So you haven't shifted like this. A lot of people have from Wikipedia to one of the LLMs as your go-to source at this point.
Yeah, I have not. It may be that is actually better, but I just haven't gotten around to it. I'm not against it. It's quite possible that is better, right? I mean, I would think about like telling the LLM, so give me the deep and historical background for these events, something like that. I think that would be a better perspective than just like what happened today, where it's like, what happened today? Like, I think it's generally true. Like just learning a lot about what happened today really actually makes you dumber.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like, this is not the most important thing that ever happened. It's not new. You call it in the news, but it's not new. There've been 100 similar things that happened. So like, why are we talking about this one or getting so upset about this one rather than 100 other things?
Yeah. And it's taking up so much space in your brain that could be used to actually learn about something that does matter, in fact. So
yes. And also so much space in your heart. So it's the amount of people, the share of people who are just angry every day because of the news, it's high. And you, in principle, you could go get really upset by reading about history, but just the distance really helps people to avoid getting too crazy.
Definitely. I always like to close on an optimistic or somewhat uplifting note whenever I can. And so one of the essays that you wrote toward the end of the book, you have at the end of the book, is you say that you're both an extreme cynic and an extreme idealist. So I was hoping you could explain how that's possible and maybe sort of lean into the idealism at the end so we can close on an up note.
Right. I'd say cynicism is like, I try to just look at the world the way it really is. I cut through the pretty lies and just see what's actually going on. Listen for literal truth. If someone says nothing's more important than education, my reaction is food's more important than education. So you're wrong. And so that's the way that I listen to people. It's the way that I talk to people in my head, even if I don't talk to them in person. So in this sense, it's like, yeah, like there's just so much stuff that's screwed up, so much stuff that could be a lot worse, or excuse me, it could be a lot better. Yeah, the idealism, on the other hand, is things like, well, I really believe in speaking literal truth. And I think this is, you know, least, you know, and if you can't get away with speaking it, at least think it to yourself. Don't lie to yourself anyway, even if you have to lie just to get through life. So I think that the norm of trying to stick to literal truth, right? The norm of saying, look, if I have thought a lot about a way to go and make my life better, and I can't think of any way that's hurting anyone who's got any claims on me, I'm just going to go ahead and do it because the world is so full of opportunities. I mean, among economists, actually, often you'll meet economists who say, first of all, everything is as good as it can be, and second of all, then things can't be improved. And then it's like, would you call that person an optimist or a pessimist? Like, on the one hand, everything's as wonderful as it could possibly be, and therefore things can't be improved. And I'd say, well, look, I mean, in a sense, that's optimism, but there's another kind of optimism where you say things are really screwed up, but it's really easy to make things better, and I'm going to be the change I want to see in the world. So I hope that's optimistic enough, because this book is a self-improvement book about how to actually live better by being a thoughtful nonconformist.
Yeah. And as with all of your collections, there's so much good stuff in there. Highly recommend it. Again, the book is You Will Not Stampede Me, Essays on Nonconformism. We will have the link, as always, in the show notes. And also, as always, yep, Brian.
And despite high inflation, I've kept the price at $12 for the paperback and $9.99 for the ebook.
Absolutely worth checking out. I would highly recommend it. And as always, it's been a whole lot of fun talking with you, Brian. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks a lot, buddy. And great talking to you, as always.
Thanks for listening to this Politics Guys interview. If you're not already a supporter of the show, I hope you'll consider becoming one, because without our supporters, we wouldn't be able to do this. And when you become a supporter, you get not just that warm, fuzzy feeling, knowing that you're supporting a good cause. I like to think we're a good cause. But you also get stuff like ad-free versions of everything we put out. You get our supporter-exclusive midweek show, the full length of that, not just the preview. And you also get to be part of our Discord group if you want. And there's always some interesting conversations going on there. At the $10 a month level or more, you get to actually be part of the episodes Jay and I do, if that's something you're interested in. So there's a lot of stuff, is what I am saying. And I hope you'll consider checking it out. And to do that, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you want to support us on Venmo, we're at Politics Guys. You can also support the show through PayPal. And all of our support links are always in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And as always, I want to close with a very special thank you to our wonderful executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.